You're listening to an SBS News podcast.
Thousands of years from now, Mr. President, the Jewish people will remember you.
This is a good day for peace and stability.
Donald Trump is the greatest friend that the state of Israel has ever had in the White House.
Thank you very much. God bless you. God bless the United States of America. And God bless the Middle East.
Welcome to World News Weekly. I'm Katrina Stirrett, and joining me is international correspondent Claudia Farhart. Hello, Claudia.
Hello, Kat. Good to be back with you on such a busy week.
I know. And no Nobel Peace Prize for Trump.
Yes, and he's not hiding how he feels about it either, Kat, especially now that he's, in his own words at least, solved a 3,000-year-old war in the Middle East. In all seriousness, though, Kat, it has been a huge week, a week I think many people had feared would never come. But after 2 years, it looks like the bombing in Gaza has stopped and Israel's living hostages have been freed.
We'll be devoting this episode to the unfolding events in the Middle East. UNICEF's James Elder will join us to unpack the situation on the ground in Gaza.
Big questions remain around whether the deal will hold and what it means for Gaza's future. We'll be chatting about all of that and what comes next with hostage negotiator Gershon Baskin.
Up first, though, is our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, who is on the ground in Tel Aviv and watched the hostage and prisoner exchange unfold.
Reunions they had dreamed of. Reunions they must, at times, have feared would never happen. Many of the freed hostages flew over central Tel Aviv and Hostages Square, allowing them to see firsthand the outpouring of support from the Israeli public.
While there has been an awful lot of celebrating here today, and understandably so, there is a tinge of sadness as well, because not all of the remains of slain hostages are being returned.
They should be on Israeli land and be buried here, and they should be with us.
The ceasefire deal saw nearly 2,000 Palestinian detainees released from Israeli jails. In Ramallah, they were given a hero's welcome, greeted by family and friends not seen in years.
It's an indescribable feeling. I cannot believe it. Thank God. We used to wait for this joy to happen.
That was, of course, the latest coverage by our chief international correspondent, Ben Lewis, who is joining us now from Tel Aviv. Hello once again, Ben.
Hello, guys.
Ben, you were among the crowd at Hostages Square gathering to watch footage on a giant screen of the hostages being freed and transported in Red Cross vans by the IDF. What was the atmosphere like on the ground as the moment Israelis had been waiting anxiously for finally came after more than 700 days of hostages being held captive?
Well, as you would expect, it was pretty extraordinary. I was chatting to one gentleman who was watching the screens, and he said to me afterwards, he said that he feels like I can finally breathe after 2 years. And that's a common thought. A lot of people were saying that over the past 2 years, life does go on. I mean, you know, people have, you know, work, family commitments, there are celebrations, people go on holidays. But every time people do one of these nice things, they would think, well, think about the hostages in Gaza. Think about my brother, cousin, friend, whoever it was. This is a small country. A lot of people personally knew the hostages or a hostage at some point. So it was a pretty remarkable moment to watch this all play out. And Hostages Square, which you might have seen on TV, became sort of the focal point for the Bring Them Home movement. And it was an incredibly well-organized movement, and it was quite organically done. These were regular people, not politicians, not experts in campaigning, just regular people who were related to the hostages who came together to create pressure on the Israeli government for action to be taken. And every Saturday after the ending of Shabbat, thousands of people would turn up down in Hostages Square for a rally to keep that pressure on, and it obviously worked. So this was a huge moment of catharsis for these people who'd put so much time and effort into getting the hostages home. And the whole thing being televised made it even more extraordinary. You had near live pictures showing the Red Cross going into Gaza, then coming out of Gaza. And then a few minutes after it happened, Israeli authorities released footage of the hostages meeting the IDF teams and then their families. And so people could go on this journey with the hostages. It was a pretty special place to be at that time.
Yeah, special moment for sure, Ben. But there's still some complications around the return of the bodies of the 28 hostages, the 28 deceased hostages still in Gaza. The deal was that they'd all be released as well as part of this, but as we're recording this, only 8 have been sent home so far. Hamas is saying it's still trying to locate all of them, but do you think this could put the deal in jeopardy?
I think it's putting strain on the deal. I don't think it's going to see the deal collapse. So as you said, you know, under the terms of the agreement, all of the bodies of deceased hostages, all 28, were supposed to be handed over by midday on Monday at the same time as the living hostages. Now, Hamas has said that's simply not possible because some of the bodies are buried under rubble. And there are probably thousands of bodies, Palestinians mostly, buried under rubble in Gaza as well. The Red Cross has said that they sort of concur with Hamas, that it will take some time to recover these bodies. Israeli authorities are pretty certain that Hamas had more bodies than they were admitting. And we saw the first day there were 4 released, and then after pressure was put on, another 4 bodies were released. We're expecting more today as well. So this is going to happen. It's just going to take a little bit longer than the Israelis were hoping. And the Israeli government had threatened to delay the reopening of the Rafah crossing and to halve the amount of aid going into the Strip, which would have huge humanitarian consequences. As we understand it, they've backed down on that threat, but that is still there. And that is something that they can use in the future, a mechanism to get Hamas to hand over more bodies if they think that the group is not transferring all of the remains it has in its possession.
At the same time, nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees were released as part of this first phase of the peace deal. Now, that included 250 convicted of crimes, including murder, and the rest held without charge. Let's take a listen. As we just heard, Ben, many had emotional reunions with family in Gaza. A number of those held were women and children, but a bittersweet reunion?
Yeah, very much so. And again, extraordinary scenes playing out in Gaza, these buses full of hundreds upon hundreds of detainees being released, being hugged, embraced in the streets. Many of them had been arrested at the start of this war and then detained without charge under a pretty controversial process here in Israel known as administrative detention. So people were then taken back to Gaza and dumped in what has obviously been a war zone for 2 years. They will have gone home to see a completely different landscape, their homes destroyed. Many will have only just found out that their loved ones have been killed during the conflict. And a lot of these detainees also were in need of medical care, and the health system in Gaza has collapsed completely. So it's going to be a very difficult return to freedom for many of these people. At the same time, obviously, a large degree of relief that they are now out of Israeli custody.
And 154 of the 250 freed prisoners were forced into exile. How's that going to go down in Gaza? Or do you think people are literally too busy surviving to worry?
Yeah, this has happened with prisoner releases before where some have been forced into exile. And by exile, we mean generally sent to Egypt is the standard thing. Look, it is part of the deal. This is what happens. Those forced into exile are generally those who have been convicted of serious offences, murder against Israeli citizens, for example. It's not much of a surprise. It happens with these hostage and prisoner swaps. I think there will be a general sense of relief that so many have been released from Israeli prisons. Where they're released to is probably not at the top of their priority list at the moment.
Donald Trump literally had the red carpet rolled out for him as he touched down in Israel before he gave a speech in the Knesset. Here are a few key moments from that.
This is the historic dawn of a new Middle East. The timing of this is brilliant. And I said, Bibi, you're going to be remembered for this far more than if you kept this thing going, 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 kill, kill, kill. Hey, I have an idea. Mr. President, why don't you give him a pardon? We are going to have hope, harmony, opportunity, and happiness here in the spiritual and geographic center of the entire world. That's what you are.
Ben, Trump got a hero's welcome, but it did feel like there were a few pointed comments in that speech in the Knesset directed at Benjamin Netanyahu. Trump told him he can be nice now that the war is over, and he was pretty effusive about the opposition leader, Yair Lapid, as well. And then he said over and over and over again that the war is finished. Do you think that Benjamin Netanyahu agrees with that, or is Trump trying to strong-arm him a bit here?
I don't think Benjamin Netanyahu has much of a choice. He was definitely strong-armed into accepting this deal. And Donald Trump explained how he did it. He apparently rang up Benjamin Netanyahu and said, look, how do you want to be remembered? Do you want to be the guy who goes kill, 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 or the guy who brought the hostages home? It was really interesting in that address too, the way Donald Trump treated Benjamin Netanyahu, the way other world leaders treat him. It was this constant barrage of praise and then sneaking in there the little things he actually wants. And the key thing was him saying, look, the war is over. Israel is not going to have any more success in this region through arms. It is a time for peace. All of that said, Benjamin Netanyahu's in a bit of a difficult position here. His government's not going to collapse at the moment because the opposition and some of the moderates will support him because the hostages have been brought home for a brief period of time anyway. But his coalition has some pretty far-right elements into it. Think Smotrich, Ben-Gvir. They wanted to see Gaza razed to the ground. They don't want to see an end to the fighting. They will keep putting pressure on Benjamin Netanyahu to try and find reasons to resume fighting, particularly with an election to be held here in Israel some point probably early next year. But perhaps one of the most extraordinary parts of that address to the Knesset was when Trump, he's sort of joking, sort of not, said that he thought that Benjamin Netanyahu should be offered a pardon by the Israeli president. Now, Netanyahu is currently still on trial over allegations of bribery and fraud. Now, the Likud MPs from Netanyahu's party, big round of applause. They love that. The opposition lawmakers looked a little bit uneasy. Speaking to Israelis here, it didn't go down particularly well. They don't like foreign interference in their politics. And remember, among a lot of the hostage families too, they don't like Benjamin Netanyahu. They think he tried to torpedo a deal to get their family members home multiple times. People here generally give Donald Trump credit for getting this deal done, not Benjamin Netanyahu. There isn't a huge amount of sympathy for his political plight and how he copes with this trial. A pardon would be a very unpopular thing at the moment.
And Ben, after 2 years watching the war in Gaza, it's easy to forget the impact October 7 had on Israel. Before we let you go, have you had a sense of how this moment might go some way to repairing their national trauma?
Look, it is obviously a hugely important moment because the names and the faces of these hostages have been at the forefront of minds for 2 years. You'd travel around Israel and on the side of the roads, there would be handmade posters with people's faces and names. Everyone wears a yellow ribbon, the symbol for the Bring Them Home movement. It has been a national trauma in many ways. This is a small country and everyone knows someone who was somehow caught up in the events of October 7. And it's why people find it so important for the remains of deceased hostages to come home as well. On television, when the Knesset address was happening with Netanyahu and Donald Trump, some lawmakers took off their yellow hostage ribbons to symbolise, you know, the hostages have been freed. And there was fury about that among the community, saying, no, we haven't got everyone home yet. We are not going to rest until the last body has been returned here to Israel. It has been an incredibly difficult time, obviously in Gaza, obviously in this country as well. People are not exactly hopeful that this deal that's been done is going to create love and peace across the Middle East, but it simply allows them some time to breathe, for the fighting to stop, for people to be able to bury the dead, for people to reconnect with loved ones who've been held hostage for 2 years. This is not going to be some miracle arrangement that sees two state solution come out of it and better relations with those living across the other side of the fence. But it is a start towards what people hope will be a more peaceful future.
Yeah, a huge week for Israel, for Gaza and for the whole region. Ben, thanks so much for taking a bit of time to chat with us today.
Thanks, guys.
Well, a key part of the peace plan was also the unrestricted flow of aid into the Gaza Strip, where it is so desperately needed. But now that promise is also being tested. For more on the humanitarian situation in Gaza, I've been speaking with UNICEF spokesperson James Elder, who was on the ground last week when the ceasefire took effect. James, thanks so much for making some time for us today.
Claudia, hi there. Pleasure.
James, what are you hearing from your teams on the ground at the moment? Has the aid going in so far made a difference?
Look, a couple of things. I mean, for UNICEF, yeah, we got dozens and dozens of trucks in on Sunday, but that was the last day based on Israeli decisions. So hoping we can get 50 trucks in every single day between now and January and beyond that, as long as there is funding. Now, there's a few things we need. This has always been political decisions. It's not logistical. All the aid is across the border, is ready to go. This is around Israel opening multiple entry points. So we heard some news today that they may open Rafah. That's very good news. And there's many others. Then you're 5 to 10 kilometres from how far people are. So that would be a positive sign. And I well understand why everyone wants good news at this point. But we have to be clear. So much damage has been done. You know, the immune system of children has never been more compromised. They've had 2 years of enforced deprivations of food, of living in tents, of a severe lack of water, of sanitation systems shattered. So the enormity of what is needed cannot be overstated. And it's not going to be changed in a week. It's not going to be changed in a month. But certainly if aid doesn't flow, as per the promises, then we will only lose more lives.
Yeah, as this war went on for the past 2 years, we saw some pretty devastating scenes around aid, particularly this year. I'm wondering now, how concerned are you about the ability going forward to sort of get this aid in, to ensure safe passage of aid into the Strip?
I think it's going to be safer passage now. If we're not one of the biggest restrictions for UNICEF, for the United Nations, well, one was having humanitarian aid blocked. I mean, look at some of the things we had blocked. We haven't been able to get an incubator into Gaza since March 2024. You know, in the first 6 months of this year, one in all three women who gave birth to a premature or an underweight baby. One in three. And we haven't been able to get an incubator in since March 2024. No education supplies for 2 years. If those restrictions are moved, then helps us enormously. At the same time, getting around the Gaza Strip has always been very, very difficult. We require approval from the IDF. We need a green light. We can sit there for hours and hours waiting for approval there. And so if those are removed and we're not fearful of bombs or snipers, then that improves our access enormously. I'm already speaking to colleagues on the ground today, and we are accessing parts of the Gaza Strip where we have not been to for months. Now, again, you can't overstate the need. Even after the ceasefire, there was a water sewage sanitation plant in Gaza City, one of the biggest, which was badly damaged by troops who were leaving. So the level of devastation, the hospitals and the healthcare, 4 in 5 homes damaged or destroyed, 4 in 5 homes. So we are in uncharted territory when it comes to damage done on infrastructure, on children. But if there is genuine political willingness, then we start to repair some of that.
Yeah, as you said, just damage, displacement, homelessness and health problems now on a huge scale. What do you think the next month or two is going to look like for you and your team on the ground in Gaza?
24-hour-a-day work. I think that there's, I mean, every sector is important. UNICEF's very fortunate there. We do cover, the full gamut, but it's probably 3. There's a famine still. Okay, so, that damage being done to a child's body is replicated in the potential damage to their cognitive ability. So nutrition is absolutely paramount, getting those nutritional supplies, not just for children, but as I say, for women as well. So that's getting into primary healthcare centres, that's getting into hospitals. So nutrition is one. Water and sanitation is another. We are a major player in terms of rebuilding water systems, in terms of getting desalination plants running again, getting people so they are not living on an emergency level of water. When you have a lack of water for children, and now we have winter conditions,
and bad nutrition, there's a collision on a child's body. And, you know, within those things, we've been planning for winter, Claudia, for a long, long time. So we want to get a million blankets, a blanket for every child, a winter pack, including shoes for every child under the age of 10. I was stunned on how many children don't have shoes. You know, this is middle-class kids, but the economy's been devastated. They haven't had, been allowed a lot of commercial goods, and people have lost incomes, and children grow. So lack of shoes. And the final big one, Claudia, is education. It is life-saving. We're in uncharted territory when it comes to the trauma of girls and boys. Never before has UNICEF talked about every girl or boy needing mental health support. That starts by reigniting the pride and joy for Palestinians in Gaza, which is their education, one of the highest literacy rates in the world. But it, like the economy, like agriculture, like healthcare, has been devastated. So, you know, we want to get 500,000 kids back into temporary learning spaces.
Yeah, James, huge challenges ahead. But I think one thing that struck us the other day when the ceasefire came into effect was the relief and the celebrations we saw. You were on the ground in Gaza when that happened. What was it like there, the moment that this ceasefire finally came into effect?
It was joyous. It's very hard to find good bits of news in Gaza. I can, you know, the human contact is immense, but I've had moments of good news where I've sat with children who've had horrific injuries in hospitals, and I've realised they're going to be okay. And I've thought, okay, this kid's going to be fine. And then I hear that their entire family, mum and dad and siblings, were all killed. So good news is few and far between. So it was literally watching kids beaming on the street. It was watching loved ones, you know, celebrate, mums and dads again. Palestinians are well aware of how flawed these ceasefire deals have been. They saw what was really charades of ceasefire attempts throughout 2024, but they hold on to hope. You know, they've had, as a Palestinian said to me, James, I've had, you know, my wife's been killed, I've lost my home, I've lost the ability to feed my children regularly. Hope is the one thing I have agency over.
Huge challenges ahead, but James, thank you so much for taking a bit of time out today to have a chat with us.
Pleasure. Thanks, Claudia.
Together we've achieved what everybody said was impossible. At long last, we have peace in the Middle East. And it's a very simple expression, peace in the Middle East. And we've heard it for many years, but nobody thought it could ever get there. And now we're there. I want to congratulate everybody sitting in these first few rows and standing behind me.
Just after the ceasefire began and the hostages were released, more than 20 world leaders flew to the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh, where the US and Egyptian presidents hosted the Gaza Peace Summit, aimed at working out the next steps of Donald Trump's peace plan.
And there is a lot to work out. For a look at what could come next, we're joined now by hostage negotiator Gershon Baskin. Thanks so much for coming on the pod, Gershon.
Thank you.
Gershon, we are very keen to get your views on all of this. There was a lot of optimism this week, as we all saw around the world. But do you think that optimism is justified given the vagueness of phase two of this 20-point plan?
Yes, I do. And I think that there's a lot of things that are not so vague and are known and perhaps not known globally and internationally and perhaps even to most Israelis and Palestinians. But there are things that are happening as we speak. The summit in Sharm el-Sheikh with 31 countries present was not the platform on which to decide the stages that are to come, but to embrace the agreement that President Trump imposed on Israel and on Hamas with an international commitment, both for troops to be sent to Gaza and for a lot of money to be put in for the reconstruction of Gaza. But the steps that are taking place right now, and some of them have been announced already, the Egyptian foreign minister last night announced that 15 Gazans have been selected and vetted by the Palestinian factions and by Israel to serve as the new temporary government in Gaza. President Abbas announced the name of a commander from the Palestinian side for the Rafah crossing that will be enhanced with a European Union presence at the border for inspection and making sure that the border is not going to be used for smuggling weapons. So all this is moving forward. Hamas is now working to find more bodies of hostages that need to be found. There are 20 more bodies. We may end up with a situation where not all of them will be found. because the commanders who were responsible for them are mostly dead. And there are thousands of Gazans who are buried underneath the rubble of buildings that Israel bombed, and they can't be found. So maybe some of the hostages won't be found, but it will not be considered a breach of the agreement because the international mechanism that was created of Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey are there to ensure that Hamas is making 100% effort and also using their own intelligence information and other help from the Israelis to try and locate the bodies. So these are a lot of moving pieces. What needs to happen immediately for the 2 million people of Gaza is that some of the rubble needs to be cleared, space has to be created, caravans and tents have to be brought in. Winter is coming, it gets cold and wet in Gaza, and 2 million people are homeless. And that needs to be dealt with immediately.
And Gershon, one of the big questions is around the future governance of Gaza. Trump's plan says it will be handed over to a reformed Palestinian authority, but the Israelis are insisting they'll never allow that to happen. Can this divide be bridged, do you think?
It's already bridged. We saw a very bizarre scene of President Abbas shaking the hands of President Trump in Sharm el-Sheikh and having a little private talk there. Just in September, the Americans prevented Mahmoud Abbas from going to America to speak to the United Nations. And there he suddenly showed up at the summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. And he appointed the commander for the Rafah crossing. Apparently, he approved the 15 names of the Gazans who will be running the temporary Gazan government. We're waiting to hear an announcement from President Abbas, which will make it official from the Palestinian side. It's a very bizarre reality because most Palestinians don't think that President Abbas actually has legitimacy. He's 90 years old. He's been the president of Palestine for 20 years. There haven't been elections for the Palestinian parliament since 2006 and for the Palestinian president since 2005. And yet he is the legal address for the Palestinian issue, both internationally and locally. So it's important that we hear from him. It won't be the Palestinian Authority of Ramallah. Gaza will be governed by Gazans for Gazans, assisted by the international community through this peace board that Trump created, that he's heading and Tony Blair will be part of. Witkoff described it to me as a kind of receivership of a bankrupt company. In other words, they'll probably deal with a lot of the finances and the billions of dollars will be entering, and they'll have to make sure that it's funneled to the right places for the right things and not taken away and avoiding corruption and all kinds of things like that.
There's also the issue of Hamas's future in Gaza. Here's a bit of what Donald Trump has had to say.
If they don't disarm, we will disarm them. They know I'm not playing
games. There's no future in Gaza because the Gazans don't want them anymore. The Gazans blame Hamas for the disaster that happened to them. Of course, they blame Israel, but they hold Hamas responsible for the decision that Hamas made on October 7th, 2023 to commit national collective suicide. And Hamas has no future in Gaza because the Gazans won't let them have a future there. This is 100% clear. Almost no Gazans want to see a Hamas person ever again in their lives.
In your experience as a negotiator dealing with Hamas, do you think they're ever going to be willing to disarm, or and are any other states, Arab states, going to be willing to step in to force them?
I think the issue of disarming is really, really exploded in its importance and its relevance. Hamas is decimated. They don't have a functioning army. They have the ability to kill Israeli soldiers as long as Israeli soldiers are there, engaging in guerrilla warfare. They don't have a lot of weapons. They don't have rockets. They don't have a lot of RPGs. They have rifles, and they have no organized military command center. Their commanders have been killed. The third and fourth level guys who are running the show today, I believe that many of them will take the option that's been offered them to leave Gaza with their families safely. I think that there will be people who will take that option. Hamas will be disarmed, not immediately, but they're not a threat to Israel. They can't be a threat to the Palestinian people. What they've been doing over the last couple of days of executing other Palestinians has to be stopped because it's despicable that they are murdering their own people. Now, Israel empowered the people that they're murdering, and a lot of these people are gangs and drug lords and other things. And this is what countries do when they're trying to occupy another country. They hire crooks to run the show. These people will be, their power will be taken away from them. And I hope that Hamas gets the message from around the world. They got it from me yesterday, that it is a horrible thing that Palestinians are killing Palestinians, and it has to stop.
Given Hamas have now handed four more bodies over, is Hamas's insistence that they don't have any more of them likely to be a negotiating tactic?
No, it's not a negotiating tactic. And I actually haven't heard it directly from Hamas people that they can't find more. They don't know where they are. They are going to continue looking. The international mechanism of Egypt, Qatar and Turkey will ensure that they are doing the job. If the international mechanism supported by the United States end up telling Israel that everything has been done to try and locate the bodies and they can't find more, then it will not be considered a breach of the agreement. If Hamas plays games and doesn't do the work, and the Egyptians, the Qataris, and the Turks, and the Americans tell Israel that Hamas is violating the agreement, then we have a real crisis. But for the time being, Hamas will continue looking. Hamas still has the ability to look and to find more bodies, and the expectation is that more of the 20 remaining hostage bodies will be found.
We also wanted to ask you about the Israeli side of all of this as well. Given that all of the living hostages have now been returned home, how much pressure do you think is going to remain on Netanyahu and his government to maintain this ceasefire?
Now, I think once we get over the euphoria of the return of the hostages and people begin to breathe again and act more normal and get back to their lives, this peak in support that Trump gave Netanyahu in the Knesset the other day is going to disappear. And there are going to be more and more calls from the Israeli public for the establishment of the National Commission of Inquiry to determine how Israel failed to protect itself on October 7th. How is that for years the Netanyahu governments have treated Hamas as an asset and the Palestinian Authority as a liability, brought the funding of billions of dollars to Hamas over the years, and created this conceptual fallacy Hamas is deterred. Netanyahu was the head of government on October 7th. He's responsible. He will not be able to avoid his responsibility.
So do you think Netanyahu has come to the end of the road then here, Gershon?
I think that decision is really in the hands of Netanyahu. If Netanyahu does a 180-degree twist and starts marching Israel toward peace with the Palestinian people and the rest of the Middle East, then he will rehabilitate himself and save his legacy.
Gershon, it has been so great to chat with you today. Thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thank you.
And that wraps up this very special edition of World News Weekly, capping off a historic 7 days in the Middle East.
If you're enjoying our pod, don't forget to like and subscribe. And remember, a new ep drops every Thursday. See you next time, Claudia.
See you then, Kat.